The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
I got a nose right here, I got a pair of ears, I got a really big mouth filled with tongue and teeth, I got a pair of eyes and a pair of hands, so now let's sing so you understand the five senses, the five senses.
We are losing our listening. We spend roughly 60% of our communication time listening. But we're not very good at it.
One of the biggest issues in interpersonal communication is the issue of listening. Be aware that listening is an issue whenever we're talking with someone, and be aware that we have to constantly work at listening in order
to... What are some of your favorite smells?
Hot coffee in the morning, smell of Florida orange groves, or maybe sniffing spray paint in a bag.
If you can't smell, you probably can't taste very well either. They are closely related functions.
So we've all got standard-issue tongues, taste buds, brains. Why does food taste differently to different people? It's okay, you've got your taste buds, they're mostly on your tongue, but you've also got some on your throat and on the roof of your mouth. Each one is contained in something called a fungiform...
This week, we're investigating some literature of the senses, in particular hearing and taste. We'll be off on an audio tour with Trevor Cox, author of Sonic Wonderland, described in The Guardian as a ramble through the rumbles, roars, and rings that comprise the great diversity of natural and artificial noises around and even within us. And we'll be following our noses with Michael Paterniti to rural Spain and the tiny village that is home to one of the world's rarest cheeses. But first, Trevor Cox is an acoustic engineer who has spent recent years travelling around the world creating a scientific odyssey of sound for his book Sonic Wonderland. His aim is to show us how crucial environment is to our perception. For example, here's some music.
Oh, my hat is frozen to my head. My feet are like two lumps of lead. I'm stuck out here, half drenched, half dead, from standing under your window.
Oh, let me in, the soldier cried.
Cold, hailing, windy night. Let me in.
Now, here's what it would sound like if recreated in that sacred ancient British monument, Stonehenge.
Oh, my hat is frozen to my head. My feet are like two lumps of lead. I'm stuck out here, half drenched, half dead, from standing under your window.
Oh, let me in, the soldier cried. Cold, hailey, windy night. Oh, let me in, the soldier cried, or I'll not come back again.
So much warmer and richer, don't you think? Well, Trevor says the way to really find out how we should listen is to go on a sound walk. So that's exactly what Richard Lee did with him, starting right here in our Guardian offices.
The idea is that Trevor Cox is going to describe for us what he's hearing via his ears, only via his ears, because we've got a blindfold on him, rather fetching scarf that he's wearing. So he's going to carry on through the office as we pursue and tell us what he's hearing, just by the magic of his ears.
Well, I can hear a trolley in the distance. I have no idea what's on that trolley. Hopefully a very large set of cakes being transported around. And actually, there's quite a lot of sound from us, you know, the rustle of the coats and things, because we're going to head outside later on. Actually, that trolley kind of obliterates almost virtually everything. There are some distant voices, so I presume we're in an open-plan office. There's a chink of some coffee cups on the right. So I presume we're near the kitchen area.
Now we need to get through this door somehow.
Door moving under your feet.
Well, I could hear it. It went further.
Sorry about the door.
Well, we see very different acoustic. We're suddenly in a much more reverberant place. We must be in a small little area. I mean, it sounds like I've gone into the toilet kind of area, but I guess we're near the lifts because the vaguely lifts were mentioned earlier on. But you, immediately on my voice, it's like when someone's on a mobile phone and they go into the toilet and you know they're sneaking in, even though they're not going to admit it. Here it comes again. So the doors have closed behind me, and I'm... It's acoustics hasn't changed that much, actually. You can tell it's like being a bit in a telephone booth, aren't you? I presume this is quite a small lift. You can hear a coloration on my voice, which is right in the speech frequencies.
And can you actually hear the difference in the ceiling heights now? That's what I'm interested in.
One of the interesting things about doing a sound walk is actually your other senses become very obvious. And actually the wind flow I've suddenly got, I don't know if we're near the outside door, and the sudden cold. Oh, there's a horrible mechanical sound.
Is that something you can identify?
Well, I would hope it's the giant printing presses of The Guardian rolling, but I bet it's not. I bet it's something like a Coca-Cola machine. You know, those really irritating vending machines which are far too noisy, and they always put them in echoey places in buildings just to annoy you particularly.
And do you want to describe what you've got here?
Well, as an acoustician, the first thing I would do is clap my hands. I have no idea if this is going to be embarrassing, because we could be in the middle of an office. And you can actually hear the sound reverberating a little. So I'm in a bigger space, and after each word, you can hear the sound coming back to me. And that reverberation is really important in lots of acoustics. I mean, particularly in, say, classical concert halls, where without that sort of reverberance, the orchestra sounds really dry and distant and remote.
And what's the interest in clapping the hands? What does that do for you?
When you're designing a hall acoustically, what you can actually manipulate, control, is those reflections. So the sound coming between me and the microphone is not really altered by whether I'm in the building or outside, but all the stuff bouncing off the walls is. So what you're doing by clapping is making a loud, short sound so you can hear all the reflections coming off the walls. And those are what, as an acoustic engineer, you can manipulate.
So what kind of reflections are we getting here?
I must say, I can tell it's a large space because it's echoing on. I mean, I suppose it's maybe half a second after I stop finishing. You don't tend to have single height space, very large areas, unless there's lots of absorbance, like an open plan office. So I guess we're probably in maybe a loading bay or something like that.
In which case, do you want to take off the blindfold and see how you did?
Well, it's low ceilings. I'm in the bike shed, actually.
In the car park. I'm in the bike shed, absolutely.
And it's a really crucial part of what we hear as we go around. Even going back to ancient times, if you go and work out how Stonehenge sounded, one of the features of Stonehenge is it would have been a little bit reverberant, which would have made it very handy for rituals. I mean, it would have made it very handy for making music in if they wanted to do that, or speaking. It's much easier to talk in this place because your sound is reinforced by those reflections than it would be in a very dead room.
Yeah, or indeed an open field before you put the stones up.
Absolutely. That's really annoying. You know, lifts telling you the doors are closing is unnecessary because you can hear the doors going chick clunk clunk shunk shunk. I've never understood why they have those. I mean, there are people who can echolocate and go around and listen and actually hear sounds and use that. You know, they either click or they may even use the natural sounds, a bit like a bat, to sort of work out how big a room is.
You talk in the book about how sometimes almost the metaphors, the language you use about the sound, are determined by its appearance. Like you talk about an ice xylophone and you say that it sounds pure. But is that because ice looks pure? Ice seems pure to us.
We don't have very many words we use often which just describe a sound in its quality. You might think about something like twang or, you know, thud. There's some sounds which are, you know, actually just purely describing, some words just purely describing sounds. But actually most of the stuff we use to describe sounds are either a description of the source. So I will just say that's motorbike. That's a noisy motorbike. I may have used an adjective. So a lot of our hearing is about identifying. So we first of all would tend to identify, and then the adjectives are quite often taken from sight and from other senses or other feelings.
The boom and the rattle of this car park, the air vent that we heard earlier, they're nothing special. But one of the reasons why we've come down here, even despite the lifts, is because some of the most extraordinary sounds that you hear in the book, some of the most extraordinary places that you go, the sounds that are so amazing are not something that's been designed at all. They're the accidental byproduct of some industrial process.
So I went to a listening station in Berlin where there's this big dome which it used to hold antennae which were used to spy in the east. And because it's a spherical dome, it's got the most amazing acoustics inside. It had nothing at all to do with why it was built that way. You know, this was to protect the antennae and to make sure the East Germans didn't know which way we were looking and spying at any one moment. But it sounds beautiful, and it's true of a lot of the places I go to. I think the leftover bits of man's creations actually have some wonderful acoustics.
Even when the buildings have been designed with sound in mind, sometimes it takes a while to get the acoustics right. for example, the Albert Hall, which was designed as a kind of venue for performances, but nevertheless, it didn't work as a kind of acoustic venue.
Yeah, it was designed before really acoustic science took hold. I mean, architectural acoustic science really started across in Harvard a bit over 100 years ago, maybe 120 years ago. So the Albert Hall was, it fundamentally is always going to be too big a space and too big an audience for a classical concert, but it's a great venue to go and hear music, and it's a really exciting venue to hear. So there's more than acoustics to it. So if you go into the Albert Hall, you'll see the mushrooms, you know, the actual discs that hang down below the dome. That's to try and reduce the volume, stop the sound going into the dome where you get echoes. That makes a big difference to the acoustics. But you're still always going to struggle.
If you're looking to design a concert hall today, what are you after?
Well, it's actually fairly well pinned down, the sort of the ingredients of what we need. So first of all, we need that reverberance. So the sound has to ring around. And that actually means you've got to have a certain volume. So a lot of concert halls, when you sit in, if you look up, they're really tall buildings. That's because we have to have a big enough volume to get the sound to echo around. And we also need to get rid of anything which removes energy, except for the audience, because the audience is very, you know, they're soft and they're sitting in soft seating. They absorb the energy. So everything else is really hard. So one of the sort of myths of concert hall acoustics is, you know, you make one out of wooden walls, it sounds good. Actually, the wood is bonded onto concrete and is not doing any vibrating whatsoever.
It's just a hard surface.
It's a hard surface. The only exception would be the stage floor. So everything's very hard. And then we know some other things which have come more recently, I mean, several decades ago. For example, we know that sound from the side is important. And the reason that's important is it gives us a sense of being in a space. So if you're outdoors, you get all the sound straight ahead from you. And, you know, go to one of those outdoor firework concerts and the orchestra sounds quite remote. It's all coming from the stage. As soon as you get sound from the side, your ears go, oh, I'm in a place. And it makes you feel involved in the music much more. So getting lateral sound. So you often see in concert halls, very narrow concert halls. And you'll also see concert halls where they have walls dividing the audience. And those walls dividing the audience are often put in to get lateral reflections, reflections from the side. So those are some of the ingredients for a good concert hall.
What kind of a reverberation would you be looking for, typically?
Oh, a couple of seconds for, you know, for romantic classical music, you want it just a little bit above 2 seconds, which means if, you know, if a musical instrument was to play a sort of moderately loud note, it would last for a couple of seconds after it stopped.
A bit like this car park, in fact.
I think, yeah, this is possibly a bit shorter than that. This is a bit like being in, I don't know, maybe in a theatre you might use for speech, where you want it to be a bit deader.
A little bit of Shakespeare then, perhaps?
A little bit of Shakespeare by the lifts of the bike shed we could do. But you know, part of the book was going to look for even more extreme places, so I actually went and measured a place where the sound rang on for nearly 2 minutes after you made a noise, and that was quite impressive.
But not the best in terms of the view that you got.
No, it was actually an oil tank, effectively. It was buried into the side of a Scottish hill, and it's basically this huge concrete tomb, which is the size of a cathedral, really. And it was full of shipping oil, and it was buried in the side of the hill to protect it from German bombing. So it was built in the 1930s. You have to go into it. You have to go down pipework. So you can't. There's no door. It wasn't designed to go into. So you actually go through the pipes, which are quite narrow. And then you're into this vast space, which is just quite incredible, the acoustics in there. I don't know what music you'd make in there, because the sound lasts for so long.
Here in the new piazza in front of King's Cross Station, we're surrounded by the thrum and the whir of modern city life. What are the major components of this soundscape?
Well, I think the first thing off to the left is actually the diesel trains. Actually, they're not that loud, but you can hear the throb of the diesel trains, which really sounds like a railway station should sound. And over to the right, we've got the typical traffic sounds. We've got squeaky brakes on buses. No doubt in London we'll have a siren in a moment. But actually, now this new piazza is, you're a bit distant from the road, it's much more pleasant than it used to be, because it used to be squashed up much nearer to the road, and it was much more impressive, both in terms of crowded and getting through it, but also in terms of noise levels. It's actually, they've not done a bad job, considering we're in the middle of essentially a traffic roundabout.
All this noise here, it's comparatively recent. The railway, the combustion engine, the brakes, all that stuff. How do our brains manage to pick through this oral salad?
Well, we're very adept at actually dealing with the fact that we've got noise around us all the time, because the hearing essentially, in terms of evolutionary terms, is an early warning system. Is someone creeping up behind us going to hit us over the head? So this sort of constant thrum of cars, we've learned to get rid of constant noises. I guess in the past it might have been the sound of rustling leaves, you know, in trees we might have just gone, we don't need to worry about those, it's not the crack of a twig. So our brains have been developed in evolutionary terms to actually blot this stuff out. But it actually does put, you know, cognitive load on the brain. So for example, if you're a pupil trying to learn in a school, your learning will be worse if you're in a noisy classroom than if you're in a quieter classroom. And there is evidence to show that this increases stress, the noise around us. And there's some evidence about whether it creates heart problems in the longer term from this sort of constant noise level from traffic.
It's also, it has some surprising consequences for other noises. I mean, I'm thinking that this ability to pick out a sound, like particularly the sound of speech, which sounds almost like a tone, can sometimes mean that other sounds that weren't designed even to exist, like, for example, the hoot from Bentham Tower in Manchester, these sounds are surprisingly striking to us.
Yes, I think that the Bentham Tower, when the winds really pick up and you have to get a really, really windy day, like we had over Christmas recently, then, yeah, it will hum, and you can hear it for miles. If you know the tone to pick out, it sounds like, I don't know, a tuba playing a note. And it waxes and it wanes because as the wind picks up and goes in gusts, it comes up and down in levels, so it's got an eerie sound to it. And being low frequency, it penetrates the buildings rather well, so I feel rather sorry for the people who have to get woken up by it in the middle of the night.
And this sound comes from some vents at the top of the tower, is it?
Yes, it's, you know, if you've ever blown across a beer bottle, you've created a nice tone at some point. It's a bit like that, and it's blowing across this, there's a glass structure right on top with loads of louvres, and it's the wind whistling past those.
So we've moved about another 500 metres or so, but the shift here is very dramatic. What's so different about the soundscape here in Camley Street Natural Park?
Immediately all the man-made noise is more distant, and of course we've got birdsong, which is beautiful. And as we walk to the park, I don't know if you noticed the ivy leaves slapping together, almost giving us a round of applause as we walk past. The man-made noises are there, we can hear the rumble of the city, but it's all more distant. And these sort of areas where you can get a bit of respite from sort of the hurly-burly of kind of city life is really important. You know, somewhere you can have a nice quiet lunch and just get away from the noise.
It's the landscape that we've kind of been designed for hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, this is the sort of landscape we used to live in. And also, actually what you see is also important to what you hear. You know, the sense of tranquility is increased by the fact that around us are trees. You know, that does actually increase the sense of tranquility.
Our expectations are so strong, though, about the natural world that sometimes when we want to reproduce this effect of a natural sound in a film or in a video game, we have to add in extras.
What you hear on a film soundtrack is almost an artificial construction, because what you're trying to do is create that archetypal sense of nature or whatever it might be. And actually, if you play back just recordings on their own, they won't quite get the impact. So actually, they spend a lot of time, let's say, making a thunderstorm. Well, they'll add sounds which might not be a thunderstorm sound to create, maybe make it more shocking, more exciting if it's, say, you know, a tense moment of a horror movie. So they do play around with the sounds, and what you hear in the cinema is very carefully engineered.
Let's, in that case, move back to the studio for our next little section. So here, in the calm of the studio, I wanted to ask a little bit about music, which you say activates more of the brain than any other known stimulus.
Yes, I mean, music has real magical powers. So we know this because, you know, if you get a really emotional bit of music, it can, you know, send shivers down your spine. So we have a really strong reaction to it. It's a bit of a mystery, music. I mean, why should we have music? What's the evolutionary purpose? It's a bit of kind of, it's something still debated. For me, probably the most likely argument is it's a socialising thing. It gets us together as groups, gets us working together. That's incredibly important for mankind to succeed, is to work together, not as individuals.
The neuroscientist Susan Greenfield suggests that as brain activity becomes correlated across larger scales, we become in some sense more conscious. Do you think music allows our consciousness to reach its deepest levels?
It has the ability to tap into the brain in a way that almost no other stimulus does, and neuroscientists love to use it as a test signal for that reason. Even if they're not into music, they use it because they can switch on and off people's emotions using it.
They can sort of see the brain light up in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, neuroscience is in a really exciting place where they're starting to map out what happens where in the brain. You know, we've got to get to the next step of understanding what that means. So it's a bit like having a map of London but not understanding how the transportation system means, but you at least know where the roads are.
Has this search for the sonic wonders of the world, has it changed you, changed the way you listen?
I think definitely has. Because the funny thing about being an acoustic engineer is you can do that looking at the maths, looking at the graphs, looking at the equations. You actually don't have to listen very often to be a great acoustic engineer if you really come from a pure scientific point of view. And it kind of reawakened my joy of listening. It was a really good excuse to go around and find find bits of acoustics that I would never have the excuse to do in my daily life and go and listen to some wonderful stuff.
Chopin's Prelude in C minor for organ, played with stalactite accompaniment in the Luray Caverns, Virginia, collected by Trevor Cox, who was enthusing there with Richard Lee. Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound, is published by Bodley Head. Now, that hoary old phase following one's nose has rarely been more literally tested out than by journalist Michael Pataniti, whose latest book, The Telling Room, begins in a Michigan delicatessen and ends in a Castilian vineyard. In between lies a tale of passion, betrayal, revenge, punishment and redemption. Not bad for the story of a cheese. Michael began by reading about the moment he discovered the Paramo de Gutsman through a newsletter written by gourmet deli owner Ari.
"Though I've saved this one for last," wrote Ari, "don't let me mislead you. This is really an outstanding piece of cheese. So anonymous, I discovered it by chance in London. It's also the most expensive cheese we've ever sold. Makes me a little nervous just putting it on the counter." The item went on to describe how this piece of sublime cheese was made in Castile, in the north-central part of the country, and how, when Ari had visited the cheesemaker himself, the Spaniard had shared vivid memories of his grandmother making the very same cheese and imploring him to keep the tradition alive. When asked by Ari how he justified making such an expensive cheese, the man had said, "Because it's made with love." But there was more. Each day, this cheesemaker collected fresh milk from his flock of 100 Chura sheep. The milk was poured into vats, stirred, and after it had coagulated, the curd was hand-cut into tiny pieces in order to expel as much liquid as possible. Each wheel of the cheese was then pressed to rid it of any remaining moisture and transported to a nearby cave. After the first aging, the cheese was submerged in extra virgin olive oil and aged again for at least a year. The stuff of his job, the minutiae, the care, the importance of time, happened to sound a lot like the job of a writer. "It's rich, dense, intense," sang Ari, "a bit like Manchego, but with its own distinct set of flavors and character." There was something about all of it, not just the perfection of Ari's prose, but the story he told, the village cheesemaker, the ancient family recipe, the old-fashioned process by which the cheese was born, the idiosyncratic tin in which it was packaged, that I couldn't stop thinking about, even as I went on to contend with misplaced modifiers in a passage about marzipan. It occurred to me that there we were living through cursed 1991 in a crushing recession when the national dialogue centered around whether Clarence Thomas had uttered the question, "Who has put pubic hair on my Coke?" And along came this outrageous, overpriced, presumptuous little cheese, almost angelic in its naivete, fabulous in character, seemingly made by an incorruptible artiste who, with an apparent straight face, had stated that its high price tag came because it was made with love. Was this for real? I went to the deli. At $22 a pound for the cheese, I had no intention of buying any. I'd come, however odd it sounds, to gaze upon it. Thus I timed my visit for in-between rushes. I picked up the finished newsletter at the door and stood for a while, reading as if the words were not only brand new to me, but the most fascinating thing I'd ever had occasion to trip over. I watched a few other nicely dressed people, quilted jackets, colorful scarves, reading it, taking pleasure in their pleasure. Then I dove in, jostling through holes in the line, moving across the black and white checked floor, until I found myself face to face with the cheeses behind the nursery glass. There were the Manchego and Cabrales, Mahon and Garracha. And there was my cheese. It seemed to hover there, a part in its own mystical world. It came in its white tin and black etching that read Paramo de Guzman. The package, which was almost oval in shape, bore the emblem of a gold medal for supreme excellence above all other cheeses, an honor from some agricultural fair, it appeared. And perched there in the display before a pyramid of the tins was a piece cut into three wedges. Unlike its paler Manchego and Mahon brethren, it possessed an overall caramel hue. It may sound strange to call a cheese soulful, but that's what this cheese seemed to be just by sight. It had traveled so far to be here and from so long ago. I let myself fantasize about what it might taste like, as I could only fantasize about a gormandizing dandy's life in which I might pen the words, "Discovered it by chance in London." And this is when an odd shift occurred inside. That little handmade cheese in the tin and its brash lack of cynicism in a rotten year gave me a strange kind of hope. I sensed the presence of purity and transcendence. I felt I knew this cheese somehow, or would. It sat silently hoarding its secrets. How long would it wait to speak? A long time, as it turned out. But when it did, the cheese had a lot to say. Unlike that day in 1991, when I felt so pressed to leave the deli in order to put the finishing touches on another one of my overheated homing pigeons of prose, it became nearly impossible for me to walk away.
Well, there begins a long and shaggy tale, a rich, dense and intense tale, no less.
Yes.
Tell us more about how you went on from this extraordinary encounter in a delicatessen.
I remember after reading his entry, I was just proofreading for him. I was proofreading these amazing newsletters that he wrote because he would wander around the world collecting artisanal products. He really truly was the Indiana Jones of food. Like, he just brought back these stories. He had this very sort of glamorous life. And I remember ripping out that entry after it showed up in the final newsletter and putting it in my wallet, where it stayed literally for almost 9 years until I came back to Europe on assignment to profile Ferran Adrià, the chef who was working north of Barcelona. And I thought, wouldn't it be amazing to try to go up to that little village in Castell and find this amazing cheesemaker who makes this sublime cheese? Ambrosio is an old Castilian, and that's how he sees himself, and that's how he lives his life. Everything is infused with magic. He is an incredible storyteller, and he talks to the animals, he talks to the plants, he talks to the cheese. The cheese talks back to him. The world, inanimate world, talks back to him. And he's one of these guys who instantly struck me as a sort of visionary and a man so out of time. We met in at his family cave, where he had once aged the cheese. There was a little room above the cave, and these rooms are called telling rooms. It used to be a room where a man would traditionally sit and count all of the casks of wine coming into the cave, and count the cheese, and count some of the items from the harvest coming in order to report to the baron exactly what had come through. But over time, these rooms transformed, and they became places where you went and you told your stories, and you ate some food, and then you told some more stories, and you told your secrets, and you told your dreams and your histories. So they became these very important sort of meeting points for the community. And in this little village of Guzman, where there were only 80 people, everybody had their own telling room in this hill to the north of town. And that's where Ambrosio is at his finest, really, truly, in this little closed limestone space, oftentimes in front of this little fireplace, telling these incredible stories about the past. And many of them are very funny. Some of them are incredibly powerful. He is one of those rare characters in this world who, when he speaks, he sort of speaks in perfect stories. And I'm someone who's, in this work, has done a fair amount of traveling around and have never yet quite met anyone like him.
One of the extraordinary things about this book is that you don't actually eat the cheese very much, do you?
No.
If you don't actually taste it for most of the book.
Pleasure denied it ended up being 13 years of wanting to eat that cheese. I wanted to eat it when I was proofreading Ari's newsletter, but I was a grad student with no money. But I got it in my head, like, someday when I'm living some version of Ari's life, traveling out in the world and collecting something and bringing it back, I will go to this place and I'm going to meet this man who apparently was pouring all of his love and purity into this product. And I'm going to see what the world is like, and I want to see what it tastes like. I want to know what it tastes like. And in Ambrosio's case, he feels so strongly that he's putting himself into everything that he does, including the making of this cheese, that you're eating a part of him, really, truly, when you eat this cheese. One of the things that happened with this cheese, and maybe this is what became interesting to me too, is that you had a man in a stable making this product from a recipe that had been in his family for hundreds of years. It was an old Castilian house cheese that they made. Ambrosio recovered this product and brought it back. And in so doing, it kind of had this little magical aura around it. And people began to try this cheese and they loved it. And it got passed all the way to Madrid, where a cheesemonger sold it. Then the royal family allegedly was served the cheese. The British royal family was then served the cheese. It was served to Ronald Reagan, Frank Sinatra, Julio Iglesias loved the cheese. And then Fidel Castro tried to buy all of Ambrosio's cheese. So in this really completely improbable way, this cheese became world famous. More and more people obviously wanted to try it. And he couldn't make all that cheese in that stable anymore. So he tried to move the company across the fields to a little stone factory with the help of his friend Julian, who was a businessman. Ambrosio is truly, he's just like the bohemian man of the fields. He wants to spend no time having anything to do with the modern world, really. He doesn't care for contracts. He doesn't care for business deals. If you shake his hand, the deal is made. Julian would bring the contracts to Ambrosio in order to execute this move. Ambrosio would sign the contracts, and he alleged that he had signed unwittingly all of it away, that he'd been betrayed by Julian, his best friend and blood brother. And when I was there that first time in his telling room, he was plotting to kill Julian.
Had he? Do you buy that version of things?
In that moment, I bought it completely. I remember leaving with Carlos at 2 a.m. in the morning and coming down the hill from Guzman under this canopy of stars and turning to him and really, truly feeling like my mind had exploded. But I said to him, are we accomplices now? Like, do we need to tell the police or do we need legal counsel? Like, what's our exposure here? There was a very specific way that he thought he might do Julian in. And that story got repeated and repeated, and I kept coming back to the village. And the more I heard the story, the more I began to think about the function of story and what was really going on here, because every time he told this story, I realized he actually was killing Julian. He told it so vividly. He told it so slowly. He would draw out certain details of it in a way. And part of the plot had to do with taking Julian to a telling room, and he was going to kill him by amputation. So he was going to kill him by keeping him alive in order that he could tell the stories of their friendship. It wasn't just me. All of Castile seemed to know that Ambrosio was going to kill Julian, and they knew how.
Then there's another moment when you wonder whether you betrayed him because you go to the new factory.
Yeah. So I feel this as a journalist sometimes. I get very involved in these long-form projects where I'll spend 3 or 4 months writing a piece, and I will spend a lot of time with people. And I know that intrinsically, in that act of writing and telling the story from my point of view, that I'm going to betray some trust. In Ambrosio's case, I'd found not just a man who struck me as an antidote to the madness of the modern world, but somebody who I needed. The one thing I realized about Ambrosio was that he was going to protect this story and his story with all of his power. And he thought I'd come to really write his legend. At the point where he realized that I was going to go talk to Julian and go talk to his lawyer, well, I think he became very nervous. And that to me felt like even a bigger betrayal than sneaking over to the factory and having, as he called it, the bastardized cheese or the dead cheese or the soulless cheese. I felt like when I turned on him as a storyteller and wasn't willing to accept the story that he told, he may have seen that as the biggest betrayal.
How did it alter your writing? It's full of digressions. It's got lots of footnotes. You go into the history of Castile. Ambrosio as a character reminded me of Jean de Florette.
The people in the village, they all have their stories, and it feels like magical realism. It feels like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. There was a man in the village, Manuel, who everybody said could fly. And he flew on this one night before Easter for a reason that unlocks this village secret that was kept for 70 years, dating back to the Spanish Civil War. I would hear bits and pieces of these tales, and I just couldn't believe it. And I would try to track. It took me 3 years to actually get to the bottom of Manuel's story. It took me 13 years to get to the bottom of Ambrosio's story. I think the story making that goes on is part of the book too, and it's part of, we have this need to tell stories about ourselves, and we tell stories, or we listen to the stories that we need to hear. So we're constantly trading our secrets in ways to explain ourselves. And so there was a lot of that going on, and that transaction became all-consuming. And yeah, I think it was this world apart and other, and I was completely enraptured by it.
Michael Pataniti there with some fascinating insights into the relationship of story and place, and not least, some clues as to how the South American genre of magic realism in Spanish literature might have magicked itself into being. The Telling Room is published by Canongate. My thanks to Michael and to Trevor Cox and Richard Lee. Next week, we'll again be deep in the countryside with new books about badger baiting and the horrors of factory farming. It might sound a bit grim, but please don't be put off. Indeed, do subscribe on a regular basis through iTunes, SoundCloud, or our pages at theguardian.com/books. Until then, from me, Claire Armistead, and producer Tim Mabey, adios.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.